pleased to be here tonight. I'm going to talk tonight about the three refuges. Let me just check and see if there's anybody here who is not familiar with the Buddhist practice of taking refuge. Okay, so I'll just say a couple of words about that by way of introduction. Taking refuge is a ritualized affirmation of one's intention to follow the Buddhist practice. That's basically what it is, and we take refuge in three things: the Buddha, the Dharma, which is usually taken to mean the Buddha's teachings, and the Sangha, which is the community of practitioners. And it's usually affirmed in a ritualistic kind of way. Many of you will have taken refuge many times. You go on a retreat, even on day-long. Sometimes we'll start the day with the ritual recitation, and we say, we repeat three times, I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha. We repeat it three times. Sometimes we even say it in Pali because that sounds more magical. But it's sort of done as a ritualized affirmation. I mean, for years I would say I take refuge in the, and basically what it meant was I like the Buddha, I like the Dharma, I like the Sangha. You know, without giving much more thought to that, it's just an affirmation and a statement of, I don't know whether membership is quite right, but we're walking a path that we think is the same as everybody else who is saying the same thing. That makes sense? So what I'd like to do is to explore, rather than taking the refuges ritually and as a devotional practice, to regard them as an investigative practice. So I'm thinking that I'm going to be asking a lot more questions than I'm going to be answering. And then at the end, you can ask them back at me if you want. I turn around is only fair play. One thing that's interesting, in the Mahayana tradition, people speak of the three jewels. There's some years between the Buddha's time and the Mahayana. And there was a lot of historical forgetfulness. People lost track of what the culture was, so the three refuges became the three jewels. The three fires became the three poisons. And the Buddha had particular reasons for using these three words. I guess the first question to ask is, what are we talking about refuge from? A refuge is a safe place. You know, some of you have been to Hawaii, there's a city of refuge there on one of the islands. Is it the Big Island? And, you know, it was pretty brutal times, and if you offended somebody who could kill you, then the only way you could save yourself was to find your way to the city of refuge, and it would be maybe, 5 or 6 acres on the beach, not a lot of greenery, but there was a little wall there. If you could get in there, you'd be safe. Safe. And so refuge, we take refuge from what? What are we talking about? I think that we're talking about dukkha, the kind of suffering that the Buddha pointed at. The first noble truth. The first noble truth is actually, the text is interesting because it's often described as the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering. But really, the text actually reads like this, and it reads like this, punctuation and everything. The noble truth of suffering, birth, aging, birth. You know, wasn't it Mark Twain who wondered why we rejoice at births and grieve at deaths? He said, I think it's because we're not the parties involved. Yeah. Aging. Sickness, death, these are existential things. Bummers all, right? And then there's kinds of pain. Pain, physical pain, mental pain, sorrow, distress, lamentation, despair. And then three real interesting ones: not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, losing what you care about. Anybody missed any of those? This is our dance card, pretty much. Nobody misses out. In fact, it's and at the prison where I do work, I do it in a mental health context where I'm not allowed to talk, or I'm not supposed to talk about the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. I say, shit happens. That list, nobody disagrees with me. So the Buddha's talking about refuge from all this unpleasantness. It's a bunch of unpleasant stuff, painful stuff. And it comes with life, and of course we are looking for refuge. What was that Bruce Springsteen song, Cover Me? Everybody's out there just trying to score. I've seen enough. I don't want to see any more. Cover me. We're all looking for refuge. We're looking for safety, security. Conventionally, what kinds of things do we use? Where do we seek refuge in the face of the pain of life? Life hurts. Sylvia Boorstein's grandfather used to say, it's hard to be a person, which pretty much gets it, I think. Life hurts. So what do we do for refuge? Conventionally, we do things like shop, eat, work, throw ourselves into work. Of course, we self-medicate. We try to make it go away. These are the realms, actually, of the third and fifth precept. The third precept, which we usually think of as refraining from sexual misconduct, actually the word is kamesu. It's sensual misconduct. It's sensual indulgence for the purpose of obliterating, making go away, trying to make go away the unpleasantness. And the fifth, of course, is not to anesthetize yourself, to obliterate that. The Buddha's intention was to engage fully. So going for refuge from dukkha. Dukkha is interesting. We've talked about it for years. This is sort of what we're in the business of talking about. But it occurred to me recently to think of dukkha as a chronic illness. The Buddha's second truth, tanha, this is our disposition. We're built this way, to want pleasantness, not like pain and unpleasantness, and try to survive and reproduce. Anybody involved in other projects? Pretty much. So what this disposition does is it generates wanting and not wanting, greed and hatred and delusion, the delusion that if we get what we want, that'll make things okay. You guys watch Mad Men? Don Draper is the ad man from the 50s or 60s, I guess. He had a great line. He said, happiness, oh, that's right after what you get what you want and just before you want the next thing. We're want machines. And we chronically produce dukkha. We're stuck with it. So what does it mean to take refuge in the Buddha? In what sense is the Buddha a refuge for us whose problems include climate change? Among other things. Actually, how do you identify dukkha? One marker for it that I found that's pretty, it may not be it may not cover everything, but find me something that doesn't. Complaint. An object of complaint is an explicit expression of dissatisfaction. whether it's justified or not. We could say such is complaint, such the origin of complaint, such the cessation of complaint. Is it possible to live a complaint-free life, a dukkha-free life? How would refuge in the Buddha make that possible? How does that even make sense? I think having an idea of who the Buddha was and what you think he did. I mean, here we are 2,500 years after his death, and we're still talking about him. You know, sort of, who was that masked man? What was that? Each of us has a different idea of who we think the Buddha is. Some people new to the practice might have a general idea. He was enlightened, whatever that might mean. Yeah. I'm sorry?
He was just able to let go.
Sure.
Grew him and didn't stick.
Well, there's a lot of different ideas. There are some people who think that what he was someone who attained some transcendent insight into the ultimate nature of reality. Some people think he let go. Some people think he perfected the paramis. Some people, the question is important because whatever your understanding of the Buddha is, that's going to be the direction of your practice. And having a direction for your practice is important. Yogi Berra said, if you don't know where you're going, then you're liable to wind up somewhere else. Or it was the Cheshire Cat, and Alice said, where are you going? And she said, I don't know. He said, well, then it doesn't matter which way you go. So having an idea of what the Buddha, who he was and what he, not even going to say attained, because that sort of prejudices the case. Once again, who do you think he was? Your understanding of him will guide your practice. And the more deeply you have a vision, the more clear your destination. We practice according to our vision. But for us, the Buddha is just an idea in our mind. Because I don't see Mr. Gautama here this evening. So each of us has a slightly different idea. Each of us has to explore this for ourselves. The idea of refuge in the Buddha is an idea that liberation is possible. How did he deal with the pain and unpleasantness of life, with that list of yucky things, that first truth? Your understanding of how he did that will determine the direction of your practice, but taking refuge in the Buddha is taking refuge in the possibility of liberation, if liberation is a word that makes sense. Because we often use these words and don't really know what does enlightenment mean. I'm not sure the two people in this room have the same idea. That's when we get into arguments. No, that's not liberation. This is liberation. If you think that if you think that the Buddha was able to not take up the three fires, to put out the three fires, greed, hatred, and delusion, your practice is going to be different than if you think that the Buddha attained the realization of some transcendent reality. So you have to, the decision is not a decision even, it's an understanding that you come to and that will guide your practice. So I'm trying to point your attention to your own understanding, or to the fact that you need to sharpen up your understanding, to think a little bit about what you think you're in the business of. Did you have a question?
We asked, who's the Buddha? And since you're hoping that you can answer some things, two things came to mind. One being that there were his disciples, I guess you call them, that were very, very scared about being in the charnel grounds. And it was very necessary from the Buddha's perspective.
Well, each of us has our own vision of the Buddha, and we could lay it out. The Buddha, when asked himself, who are you? He said, if you know dependent origination, you know me. And he doesn't mean dependent origination like as in that picture of that wheel and the chain of dependent origination that gives rise to suffering. And the fact that he is a dependently arisen phenomenon. And we are dependently arisen phenomena. So there's our Buddha nature right there. That's what he offered when asked. Refuge in the Buddha's, the idea that there is a solution, a salvation possible. Refuge in the Dharma. What, you know, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, this would be the refuge in the idea that there is a recipe for getting to where you think the Buddha got to. And hopefully your idea of the recipe bears some resemblance to, you know, if you think you're cooking a cake, I hope you're using flour and butter and water and eggs. And not roast beef. You know what I mean? Just saying. You know, but the question then becomes, how do we know what the Buddha taught? I think of the teachings, the Buddha's teachings that come to us today as sort of like the end of a 2,500-year game of telephone. You know, there's been a little bit of addition, a little bit of deletion. Fancy, I mean, my gosh, 2,500 years. You can watch it happening even now. So when we translate the Metta Sutta, we translate, I'm sure you've heard this verse, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. You heard that? That's not the way the text reads. Even as a child, as a mother protects with her life her son, her only son. But that doesn't quite accord with our sensibilities today, so we don't feel any problem in making an adjustment. Well, 2,500 years worth of those adjustments, also by people who might not necessarily have understood what the Buddha was talking to or talking about. So how do we tell, how do we recognize what is the Dharma and what is fake Dharma? Oh my gosh. So there's an absolutely wonderful site called, really, fakebuddhaquotes.com. And I check it out. It's just quite entertaining. I'm gonna read you a couple of things. They put stuff up, you know, this is attributed to the Buddha. One moment can change a day, one day can change a life, and one life can change the world. Gautama Buddha. Or, I like this one. He who experiences the unity of life sees his own self in all beings, and all beings in his own self, and looks on everything with an impartial eye. That's out of the Bhagavad Gita, and definitely not the Buddha's teaching. Some of you may know my wife has a few Dharma books out there, and in them, she's quoted the Buddha. If you Google some of those quotes, you will see those quotes attributed to her. Yeah. All things subject to arising are subject to passing away. Tony Bernhardt. Really, So how do you know which is which these days, or any days? How do you recognize the Dharma from not the Dharma? The traditional teaching runs. The traditional teaching is brought to us through the Theravadan tradition, anyway. Runs something like, over the course of many lifetimes, one who's dedicated to the practice can perfect the paramis, earn merit, follow the precepts, and on the basis of the good karma that develops over lifetimes, create the conditions which enable the realization of nibbana, which is a transcendent reality that is the deathless and not affected by the vagaries of life. Isn't that sort of more or less general idea? There are elements of faith in there. Belief in karma, multiple lifetimes. And, Bhikkhu Bodhi will tell you that right view, right understanding, the first element of the Eightfold Path, depends on your understanding of multiple lifetimes and how karma carries over from one life to another. I'm not so sure that that's the case, because I don't see the Buddha saying those things in the early texts. Some of those early texts are kind of screwy. I've been told by monastics that you have to take it all or none. That you take it all, but if you don't understand it, I think it's in the Middle Length Discourses, there's a story about the Buddha is born and he hits the ground and he takes seven steps and there's an umbrella held over his head and he says, heaven above and earth below, I am the honored one. You think? Yeah. And there's also in there, there's the 37 marks of a great man, or maybe it's 97. There's a lot of marks. And if you actually read it, it's a pretty weird looking creature. Standing upright, his hands go below his knees. He's got wheels on his hands and he's got legs like a gazelle. It doesn't say whether they're the front legs or the back legs, but I'm not sure it really matters. So what about that one? No? Yeah. There's even a great story where the Buddha, where he utters his last words. All compounded things are subject to passing away. Strive on with diligence. And then he closes his eyes. And they're watching him, and he puts his mind through the states of higher concentration, and he reaches the eighth jhana, and Ananda, his cousin, is looking at him and saying, oh, we've lost our teacher. And Anuruddha, the Buddha's other cousin, says, nah, not yet. There he's at the eighth jhana, and then he goes back down to the first jhana, and then back up to the fourth jhana. It's a long trip, and then he dies. So I was sitting in a classroom setting, and there was someone teaching this, someone in robes, and I put up my hand. I said, how do we know that? It was going on inside the Buddha's head. Oh, because Anuruddha could read minds. And I thought, maybe, I don't know about picking and choosing. If you pick and choose, at least know the basis on which you pick and choose. And I choose to pick and choose on the basis of my own experience. I mean, we've got our experience to go on. That's what we've got to go on, right? So I pick and choose according to that, if it seems... I certainly believe that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in any of our scenarios, much less philosophies. You know, I mean, well, you know. But I don't understand a lot of that stuff. And it doesn't really matter for me. But it still doesn't avoid the question of how do you tell what the Buddha's teaching really was. There are several solutions to this. Analio Bhikkhu, who's the senior scholar on the planet. He and a guy named John Peacock are the only two people I know who translate in all of the ancient languages, the Chinese and the Sinhalese, the Tibetan, the Pali, the Sanskrit. And they're, you know, Analio, he just says, I don't study anything post-King Ashoka, about 150 years after the Buddha. All that other stuff is unreliable. There's even a sutta where the Buddha says, it's called the Peg, where the Buddha says, the words of the Tathagata are deep and hard to understand, and in the future, people will pay attention to poetic discourse and not to the hard words of the Buddha. And he said there was a drum once this tribe had, and you could hit it and hear it for 7 leagues. I don't know what a league is, but I guess it's a while, it's a ways. And over time, the wood would crack, and they'd put a peg in it to keep it from rattling. And after a while, it was all pegs, and you couldn't hear it in the next room. He says, that's what's going to happen to the Dharma. So Analio says, okay, we'll just settle for the early texts. But, you know, some of the early texts are stepped on, too. Stephen Batchelor has a slightly different approach, and it's pretty interesting. He says, he also reads in a bunch of the other languages, not all of them. But if you read all of the Sanskrit texts of the time, and you read the Pali texts that were the Buddha's, the writings of the Buddha's teaching, and you look at what's in the Pali texts that aren't in the other texts, he says, well, that's a clue. This is stuff that the Buddha added. And there were a few things that jump out. The first is that you're in it for yourself. It's up to you. No priest, no Brahmin can save you. You can only save yourself. Your personal responsibility becomes the center of things. No church, no ritual can absolve you. You'll suffer or not according to your own practices and beliefs. He added the mindfulness practice that we do. Concentration practice was already around. And in fact, when the Buddha went forth, he studied with some concentration masters, and he was pretty good, I guess, and he mastered them fairly quickly. Within about 6 months, he went through two teachers, and they offered him a spot heading up their sanghas. And he said, you know, this is not in the early text. He said, you know, this is pretty good stuff, but when I open my eyes, same old, same old. I'm looking for a solution to the problem of dissatisfaction and suffering. The mindfulness practice, which is the practice we do where we make the content of our experience, all of our experience, both our intentions and our perceptions, our feeling tones, physical experiences, our reactivity, we make that the object of our attention. Mindfulness practice, the Buddha added. He also ethicized behavior, made the actual actions that we take matters of ethical concern. For the Brahmins at the time, your job was to perform your responsibilities, the responsibilities of a person of your caste and your location and your gender and whatever. The Buddha said that the task is not to make things worse, not to add more suffering to the mix, and to decide whether what you are about to do is for the benefit of yourself or others or not, and refrain when it's not. So he emphasized action, right speech, right action, right livelihood at the heart of the Eightfold Path. And that's the fruit of the practice, to be able to live without suffering, speaking, acting, and assembling a life without hurting yourself or others. He formulated the problem of human suffering in the format of the Four Noble Truths. For the Hindus at the time, change was suffering. But the Buddha said, no, it's change plus clinging is suffering. The four truths, like complaint, such the origin, such the cessation. And how do you put an end to complaint? How do you put an end to dissatisfaction? The Eightfold Path was something he added to the mix. And the Eightfold Path is interesting because the task the Buddha assigned with it is cultivate this path. The first element of the path is right view, right understanding, right story, the narrative, your understanding of things. If I ask you what's going on, you'll tell me a story. You'll explain to me something about what's going on, and that will be your view, your understanding. Whatever it is, Big Bang or, oh my gosh, did you guys see? It's in the paper today, there's stuff before the Big Bang. Really? Astronomers discovered some star that's older than the Big Bang. What does that do to your cosmology? Anything? Maybe not. We're still trying to deal with climate change. But the Buddha said that one of right understanding, everything else follows. For one of delusional understanding, everything goes south. One of right view will have right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So the task is to cultivate right understanding. That's the Buddha's charge. We think often that our task is to meditate a lot. You know, the more the better. You know? So if you think that your job as a Buddhist practitioner is to create pleasant mental states, you'll be doing a different kind of practice than if you think your task is to alleviate the suffering of those around you and to manifest compassion in the world. And that will be different than if you think that your job is to monitor your intentions and curate them so that harmful intentions go unexpressed. The ending of complaint. And then the Buddha added something else, and that was the teaching of emptiness, which we can cover in about 30 seconds here. But emptiness is the same as dependent origination, the same as the middle path. Emptiness is just the notion that the concepts that we use, it's not a whole lot different from the first law of general semantics. The map is not the territory. We think this is a thing, but there are no things because everything is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without abiding essence. We think this is a thing because that's how our brains are designed to work. They make nouns and verbs. Spiders make their webs in circles, we make nouns and verbs, and then we think they're things. But, you know, the molecules in this, the atoms that weren't a pen, and it won't be long before they're not a pen again, really. In the Zen tradition, they say, what is this? Say it, tell me it's a pen, I'll hit you with it. If you say it's not a pen, I'll hit you with it. What is it? I know. It's why I practice in the Theravadan tradition. So the emptiness, the notion of the emptiness, the insubstantiality of all stuff means that there's nothing really to grasp, and we think of ourselves as agents, but that's really a mirage. That doesn't mean we don't see it. You see a mirage, but once you know that it's just reflected light off rising heat, you don't go chasing it if you're thirsty. One of the big clues that the Buddha offered was that he teaches a dharma that doesn't contend with anyone. He said, I do not dispute with the world. The world may dispute with me, but I do not dispute with the world. If you're looking to put your finger on the dharma, look there. And this is some place for you to look, because, boy, I don't think a committee made that up. You know what I mean? There are people who say, well, you know, the Pali Canon has been stepped on and adjusted, but, you know, there are jokes in there. And I don't know a committee that can produce a joke. And committees are hotbeds of contention. I teach a dharma that doesn't contend with anyone. He said, I teach suffering and the end of suffering. Dukkha and the end of dukkha. And, you know, one of the teachers I followed early on, Ayakema, used to say, everything besides the Four Noble Truths is excess dharma. The Four Noble Truths articulates his understanding of the dissatisfaction that we have with life, that we find with life. And his approach, his prescription is the Eightfold Path, it seems to me. So the Buddha is teaching us, or pointing out, how to live without dukkha. And so this, the refuge that is the Dharma is the refuge of having a recipe to make that enlightened being, or the awakened being, or a Buddha. Thich Nhat Hanh said, just because the Buddha was a human, it means that countless Buddhas are possible. And at a certain point in your practice, you want to trust yourself. Because you really, in the end, how do you recognize the Dharma? Well, the Sangha is a place. Refuge in the Sangha. the Sangha is the Pali word for, well, it's not entirely clear. It sort of means community. So imagine back in the time of the Buddha, you hear that this guy Gautama he's got some good ideas. How do you go find out what's going on? You can't log on and, you know, type Buddha, good ideas. Well, maybe you could if you were in a UFO, but maybe not. So you would look for the people who hung around the Buddha. That would be the community of people who had been listening to him and knew. You would go to the Sangha. That was the place where you would find the Buddha's teachings. So refuge in the Sangha is refuge in the place where you find the Buddha's teaching. Now, I know a lot of us have seen or have heard the story about how the Buddha was hanging out with Ananda, his cousin, and they're looking out over the assembled throngs of monks, and probably nuns at that time too. And Ananda says to the Buddha, you know, this Sangha business is pretty important. Must be half the holy life. And the Buddha says, don't say that, Ananda. It's all of the holy life. You know that story? It's out there. It is. But I tend to think it's propaganda for the Sangha. Because, well, you know, there was a lot of propaganda needed. The Buddha died. You needed patrons. You say, hey, my teacher had an insight. Hot stuff. You know, that's how you get the noble truths and, you know, the omniscient. You know, the Buddha becomes more than a human in order to sort of sell Buddhism. Well, that's my own take. And you can ignore that if you like. But the Sangha at that time was, at the very beginning, was just it was understood just to be the collection of people who were fully awakened. And the people who met at the first council after the Buddha's death to consolidate the teachings into the Nikayas, as we know them, that was the Sangha, and there were 500 of them. There were 499 the night before they convened, but Ananda had a complete awakening sometime between the time when he was vertical and as he lay down, he had he touched the third rail and he lit up, and so then they had 500 of them. But it was the fully awakened beings. But you know, then time went on and it came to be understood to be the community of monks and nuns. The monastic community was the Sangha. And you can still see remnants of this. There's a Tibetan monastery in the Santa Cruz Mountains behind Boulder Creek called Vajrapani. Some of you may have been there. And you stand, as you're getting into the food line, there's a sign on the wall that says, out of courtesy, we serve Sangha first. Still the notion of Sangha being the nuns in residence. But, you know, we like to be Sangha. In the West, we're doing it differently. We're doing practices that used to be just done by monastics because lay people didn't have time to go on retreat. You know, they didn't have time to, on what is this, Thursday night? I'm in trouble. It's Thursday night to come and listen to it. So it was the monastics were the Sangha. But we like to be included, so we describe our groups as Sangha. How is Sangha? You know, the Buddha also said, if you can't find a suitable companion in the holy life, walk alone like a tusker elephant. You can find that in the Dhammapada. You can find it in the Sutta Nipata. You can find it in many early texts. Walk alone. Sangha is all of the holy life. What's the deal here? You know, the Buddha would say middle path. And I'm sure that that doesn't mean just a few people. And today, you know, I sort of take a slightly different perspective. For me, the Sangha is the culture of awakening. So I take an anthropological kind of, because the internet makes possible, you don't have to go find the people hanging out around the Buddha now. You just log on and you can get fake Buddha quotes to your heart's content. But you can hear, you know, you can hear Dharma talks from people anywhere. My wife has some friends in Australia who are living on the edge of the outback, and they can't believe she knows Gil Fronsdahl because they've been listening to him for years. And, you know, oh my gosh, you know Sylvia Borson, you've met her, oh no. You know, the internet books are artifacts. You can get a book, you know, Do you need a teacher? What is a teacher? I think the issue of teachers is really interesting. How do you recognize a teacher who's actually teaching the Dharma? I've had some people suggest to me, it's because, you know, most teachers are like me, you know, we're like you. So they say the idea is perfect teaching, imperfect teacher. I don't buy it. How would an imperfect teacher recognize the perfect teaching? And if you recognize the perfect teaching, wouldn't you be living it? So I think the question of how you recognize in a teacher, you know, in the end, you have to depend on yourself to evaluate the teacher. How do you know? I've been working on this problem for some time because I meet a lot of students who are just starting, and I want to be able to offer to them some clue as to how to distinguish between a fruitful path and one that's going to be a dry hole, you know? And the only thing that I've been able to come up with is raising the issue and saying you have to watch out and constantly check with yourself. You know, you can find people who will persuade you of all kinds of things. You know? So for me, I depend on my own experience. Now that's, you know, I was at a session with Joseph Goldstein once, and he still does, I'm sure, teaches teachers, teach from your own experience. Don't teach by hearsay. And so one of the group who was a smallish group was with him, and one of the people said, well, you teach about rebirth and reincarnation. Do you have experience with that? And he said, no. Well, why do you teach that? And he said, out of respect for the tradition. So how do you evaluate that if you're just dealing with a teaching that's presented to you as, you know, we got climate change problems because we're morally insufficient. We've been messing around with greed, hatred, and delusion too long, and it's karmic payback. What do you do with that? So the question, and you know, there are teachers, as we know, who have fallen from grace. There are politicians who've fallen from grace. You know. Not, what do we do about a Pablo Picasso? You know? What do we do about a Noah Levine? You know? Or an Al Franken? I don't have an answer, but that's an issue. A Richard Baker, you know, Richard Baker was the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center after the passing of Shunryu Suzuki. And, well, he isn't anymore because it turned out he was sort of not living the Dharma, as it were. How do you know? And people were stunned. There's a whole book on it. It's called Shoes Outside the Door. You know? How do you recognize a teacher who's teaching? How do you? But still the Sangha, the culture of awakening, it's where we go now. But if you go there, how do you know? How can you tell a fake Buddha quote? I mean, a lot of the fake Buddha quotes come from Spirit Rock. Well, they come from my wife, too, you know. We can all get in on it. You know, trying to come up with an understanding for yourself of what the Buddha attained, refuge in the Buddha. Understanding, in a way, the teachings of how to become a Buddha. That will determine your practice. Whether you practice jhana, intense jhana, or choiceless awareness. Two Burmese Zen masters, Pawak Sayadaw. You know, I've sat with him. He says, what's your practice? Well, I do Vipassana meditation. Oh, no, you don't. You can't begin to do Vipassana until you've mastered all eight jhanas. Another Burmese meditation master, Utejaniya, choiceless awareness. Close your eyes and see what appears in your mind. Totally different approaches. Which one is right? Or are they both right? How do you know? The second factor of awakening is investigation. Mindfulness is first and then investigation. And what you investigate and discover, you keep. Teachers can point the way, point the direction for you to point your attention, but you've got to do the looking. Refuge in the Buddha, refuge in the Dharma, refuge in the Sangha. It includes an understanding of the entire enterprise we're involved in. What do you think you're doing? How are you doing it? How are you going about doing it? And how do we live our lives? You know, day to day, right? Speech, action, and livelihood. We don't have a lot of time, so we need a crash course. If we take it seriously, we will proceed. So let me just pause and see if there are any questions, comments, complaints. I'm up for complaints. Anybody?
Thank you.
Thank you.